Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. My friend Greg Pennoyer, who sits on the board of Prison Fellowship International, introduced me to Andrew Corley, who became the president and CEO of PFI a year ago. I welcome the opportunity to meet for several reasons. First is the work in prisons. Through the Ephesus Project, colleagues and I have engaged over the last few years. Second is Andy's formation and service through the Salvation Army, an evangelical church that befriended my mother in Norway when she was a small child. Evangelicals have long been leaders in prison ministry around the world. Charles Colson, chief counsel for President Richard Nixon, founded Prison Fellowship following his guilty plea in the midst of the Watergate inquiry and his incarceration at the Maxwell Federal Prison Camp in Alabama for 7 months. There are now national prison fellowships in 119 countries, spanning various cultures and religious communities, and Prison Fellowship International works with all of them, assisting in ways to enlarge their good work. Andrew developed his strategic thinking and leadership skills in management and as a director for global construction material companies. I welcome you to our conversation, moving from his way of shaping business and questions of purpose, on what it means to be salt and light in the marketplace, and on how working in prisons is transformative for those who enter behind the walls of separation.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
A little earlier this morning, in response to my wondering how you came to the work you do, you are the president and CEO of Prison Fellowship International. I know a little bit about that from reading the New York Times and finding out that Charles Colson was going to prison, and knowing full well that prison transforms everybody, and it certainly did with him. And so he ended up forming Prison Fellowship and eventually Prison Fellowship International, and our mutual friend Ron Nickel had that position for a long time. How do you come to this? What has been the way in which a young man raised in the Salvation Army, a follower of Booth and that wonderful social ministry that the Salvation Army has conducted for so many years, even touches my life, because my mother in Norway, her mother died when she was a year old. But before that, the Salvation Army had really been very important for my mother, and through her early life before she came to Canada, the Salvation Army had people there, women there, had treasured my mother. So I have a personal sense of gratitude for the movement that shaped your early life and then your business life. So lead us into that a little bit. How do you come to this?
Well, I have that same sense of gratitude, David, for the tradition that I was brought up in and the family history that I have on both sides of my family. We went back four generations in the Salvation Army, and that gave me a very rich heritage. I had a wonderful mum and of blessed memory, and a father who is still alive, who taught me some very great lessons and brought me up in a home that had faith there, and for that I'm extremely grateful. But aged 18, I had my own personal encounter with God in the person of Jesus as an alive person. And that led me from there to seek, I think, a meaningful, ongoing dialogue, if you like, with him, and to explore what that meant to be a holistic disciple. And we've talked this morning a little bit about language, and I'm not even sure that my language is very good at even at this point, but I think my desire was to...
All language is good.
Yeah, yeah. Was just to be authentic, I think, and to seek to be wholehearted in my love for him and from that, loving other people as well. Now, the journey that I then went on was not a very usual one, which was that it was very clear to me that I needed to... And this occurred when I was 18 years of age. I was on my way to university to study geology, which I completed.
Was this in Derby?
I studied geology at Liverpool University. And I was also a very passionate sportsman at that time in my life as well, and realized that the Salvation Army is an organization that at its core does have heart to God and serving their fellow man, and so I was brought up in that rich way, really. But the thing that, or the area that I kind of travel into, was into business, and that raised all sorts of questions for me and all sorts of opportunities to try to be an authentic follower of Christ in the marketplace. I'm sure I failed many times in that, and I certainly, for a good period of my life, as many of us do, I lived with a sacred secular divide, always feeling that I wasn't quite in my zone by being in the business world, only to find that actually the opposite was true, and that God wants his people in every sphere of what we call life and service. So that my career developed, and I was had some measure of success in global companies, and then building a small business with a couple of other people into a very successful organization. And it was as a result of that that I was invited 9 years ago to attend a conference in South Africa organized by the Lausanne Movement, where for the first time ever they invited a couple of hundred people who were business people, politicians, media, and some arts folk as well. And
this was largely European and North American evangelicals, if I recall correctly.
It was actually global. It was people from all over the world.
But yeah, largely from the evangelical world.
That's right.
To actually think about how should the evangelical world work and live out its vision in the 21st century.
Correct. That's right. And there was a lot of holistic thinking, the usual kinds of debates around works and, do we preach by words or preach by works? And there was a good proportion on things like creation care, and it was very wide-ranging, but it was exactly what you said. It was in the 21st century, how do we articulate what it means to be authentic followers of Jesus? And for the first time, the movement invited this relatively small group, but nevertheless, that they identified that in the marketplace there was an opportunity to model something which is in line with biblical principle and the good that we know that Scripture talks about, some of the opportunities that exist for us to be both influential and salt and light. And so I was invited to speak at that and share just some of it in a very small way, some of how we were trying to do that
in the context of your business.
In the context of our business, that's right. It's called Models of Hope.
So what particularly did you pull forward from that?
Well, I talked about how for many men and women, having a business which is run on biblical principle or kingdom principle how that might be their only brush, if you like, with some of the things that we know are so healthy and so full of who God is, if you like, and how that can be extremely helpful in individuals' lives, how demonstration of community and largely driven by this mantra of that many companies have, that people are our number one asset, but we really don't act like that, or commercial companies don't act like that, and how there's an opportunity to model some very healthy things there.
So biblical principle, kingdom principles. What do you mean by that?
So I mean that there, I think that the scriptures give us a real understanding of the fact that if we pursue money as a sole objective, that can very often be destructive. In fact, I would say it's not very often. It is destructive, period. But that the creation of wealth in its own right doesn't necessarily need to be driven in a way that is destructive. I'm aware straight away that I'm talking about the creation of wealth here, and that wasn't the only thing that I think is important, but that there are ways of existing in a world of commerce and in a world of wealth creation that are good and can be healthy, but they are ways where people really are valued as opposed to being just tools in order to be bigger, stronger, faster, more profitable. I would say that is it turns some principles on their head around what the purpose of business is, which is a big debate. Is it just to have more and more and more, or is there more to life than just that? And I think we haven't figured that out totally, but as in our world, and actually we see a lot of very destructive policies as a result of slavish pursuance of just money. But I think that Christians have viewpoints and worldviews which are well worth listening to in this regard.
So the central one is that people are not simply personnel.
Correct.
People are human beings in the image and likeness of God. And if you shape a business, you must shape it. If you shape it in reference to your faith, you must shape it with real regard for the humanity of the people that are working for you and with you. And also, in terms of the service, I would assume, of that business, a regard to speak with clarity to genuine human need and what is fruitful for human beings.
Correct. And that's driven out of an understanding that people are created in the image of God, and they are the pinnacle of, we are the pinnacle of what God created, and therefore even in the world of work, there's a sanctity about that. There's a sanctity about work, and there is also very definitely a sanctity about people that we could do well to consider how we elevate that above the profit-making motive.
So the Lausanne people invited you to come and speak about how you had been doing this in your business, both the regard for the people that work with you and about the sanctity of work. So that's interesting, because I've been interested in this question of what I would call work as a part of the spiritual life.
Yeah.
And Pope John Paul II wrote what I think is really one of the most remarkable reflections on the spiritual dimension of work, really many years ago. And he wrote it in part because he had been confined to the salt mines under the Soviets. Hmm. And he had a visceral sense of this whole matter. So you spoke about that at Lausanne, and then what happened?
Well, I spoke about things like the sacred secular divide and tried to be vaguely humorous in saying that, you know, in the evangelical world, if you're deeply spiritual, then you become a missionary, and if you're semi-spiritual, you become a pastor or a youth worker, and then the rest of us get a job. And trying to make people laugh about it, but articulate a very real dilemma, I think, which is that there are no second-class citizens. We're all called. It's just a matter of figuring out where and to who and how we can serve people in the most effective way. And so these were the kinds of things that I was talking about. And in the audience was Ron Nickel, who was the CEO of Prison Fellowship International. And I don't quite know how Ron reacted to it. I don't know whether he enjoyed it or not. But certainly what transpired from that was that I was invited to attend to meet some of the board members of PFI out in Washington in the first instance within the next 6 months. And then the following July in 2011, I was privileged to serve on the board. And that's how I began my association with this amazing global family.
Ron Nickel, as you perhaps know, is an Albertan. He actually came from southern Alberta, although for those of us that live in Edmonton, southern Alberta is actually probably part of Montana. But I have enormous admiration for Ron Nickel and his work over time.
Yeah, me too.
So you served on the board, and things unfolded there, and you began to ponder and think about a variety of things, and then you have come to be asked to serve fairly recently as the CEO and president. How does that come about, and why do you respond to that opportunity?
Well, in terms of how that came about, there was an opportunity to liquidate my shareholding in the business that I had built with a couple of other people, and concurrent with that, the CEO of the current CEO of PFI at the time also indicated that he wanted to leave. So there was an opportunity that arose for me to the board asked me if I would be interested in that, and the answer clearly was yes. But it was a very definite yes. I think I had really felt that the opportunity to serve men and women who are behind bars and their families had deeply impacted me, that I had felt that it was one of the great privileges of my life, and that in my own spiritual journey that I had grown enormously and been privileged to be associated with PFI. So it wasn't a particularly hard decision to say yes, because I'd really come to value what we were doing, this global family of rich diversity, but also it was the opportunity to serve, but it was also the opportunity to learn more about who God is, the nature of who he is, the things that are really close to his heart, what it means to be created in God's image, and in serving groups of people that are close to God's heart, actually what it means to be more human. So for me, it was an opportunity. Sounds very selfish when I put it like this, but it was an opportunity both to serve, but also an opportunity to really grow as well. And I just loved what we were doing. I mean, I really do love going into prison. I can't express it any other way.
So Prison Fellowship International is a kind of, if I understand this correctly, a kind of umbrella that is in service to prison fellowship organizations that are national, that are in how many nations of the world?
We're in 119.
119 nations. Yeah. You have a prison fellowship organization, and Prison Fellowship International is the umbrella that sees itself in service to those particular national bodies. And it is those national bodies, do I understand this correctly, who, through calling together various volunteers, work within the prison with people who are incarcerated and with their families and sometimes also, in my discussions with Ron Nickel, work with prison administrations and also with departments of justice around what constitutes real justice in our world and the various ways in which people who are incarcerated can be engaged so that, in fact, they can enter the civil world again without deeper wounds, but maybe with some of those wounds healed. Do I have that correct?
That's a great way of describing it. We have national ministries in 119 countries, each of which is independent and indigenous. So the global family really hangs together out of relationship, passion for your love, loving God with all our hearts, soul, and strength, loving our fellow man as expressed in our fellow co-workers, other national ministry leaders, other volunteers, etc., etc., and to those that we serve. So that becomes very live and becomes a glue on a global scale, the beauty of which is that all of those national ministries then take responsibility for the expression of service to those who are behind bars that they think is most appropriate in their own context. It is true that so here in Canada, you have a wonderful National Ministry Prison Fellowship Canada, obviously. They make the decisions about what is best for them to both respond to the call that God has placed upon them, but also what they consider to be the most appropriate way of serving the prison population. Now, what we do from the Secretariat is that our whole raison d'etre is to serve the other national ministries. And we do that in a particular way. One of those ways is to help national ministries in what I would call developing country contexts where resources are very tight, where it can be really helpful to place tools into their hands. Then we have core programs that we enable them, train them, enable them to run, put startup funding their way to really kick them off. But all of that is done with the intent of not in any way dominating them or in any way creating dependency. We're actually trying to create a capacity building scenario for them that they grow through the work that we do, and we serve them in that we walk on a journey with them to enable them to be all that God has called them to do.
So let me ask you the tough question. Prison Fellowship International was formed in the United States of America. I studied in the United States. I have a regard for the United States, but I also have a little knowledge about American culture and also about American evangelicalism with its enormous gifts, most of which are overlooked in the public sphere, and many of which people that claim to be evangelicals are a bit unconscious of these days, but gifts nevertheless. I'm not, I think, like most typical Canadians who tend to have a negative view of the United States. I appreciate the United States in many ways. But I also know that American organizations, and certainly American organizations within the context of the evangelical world or influenced by the evangelical world, often have a particular stance towards their international work. You speak with a beautiful accent from England, and you are located in England, but you are running an organization which historically has been largely in the context, worked out of the context of American culture. Is there a kind of cultural task that you are taking on here to move that organization to a kind of another second generation of its way of working internationally? Is this even a reasonable question to ask?
I think it's a very good question to ask, and I think the answer is yes. I too have much to thank the evangelical family in the United States, because actually the United States, when I referred earlier to when I was 18 years of age, that was where I first was challenged about who Jesus is. That happened here. It happened in the United States when I was 18 years of age. And that really did change my life.
I always thought that Jesus was Palestinian, and now I'm discovering he was an American.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. But that the United States was where somebody was bold enough to actually ask me about that. And I had been brought up in the Salvation Army for those first 18 years of my life. But it was the boldness with which the person of Jesus was presented to me that was really helpful. But of course, it's not meant to stop there. And that has been true in my own life, is that as I have, you know, in my own evangelical language, if you like, as I became a follower of Christ and accepted him as my Lord and Savior, then that can't become a position of static. That you'll put the words around this, David, but that's not a static position. We the early church described themselves as followers of the way. It was always meant that this walk with a living God would be a dynamic thing, and indeed that's exactly what happened for me. So I think that the journey that we go on, we have much to thank evangelicals for. I still being one, I think in terms of the way that I would describe myself, but the ability to see the richness in other Christian confessions has been a wonderful journey for me. Really expanded my view of who God is, what he is about in our world, has just been such a rich thing in my life.
Yeah, the church is much larger than we imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. And so is God. Mm-hmm. And I continue every day to... This latest role that I've stepped into, I think, is just stretching my understanding of who he is in incredible ways, which I'm very grateful for. But to go back to your question about the movement of the organization, I don't want it to sound arrogantly like we're heading in a new direction. I think what we are doing is we are picking out the richness of this global, multi-ethnic, multi-confessional family of men and women who, you know, we run the spectrum from people who've spent time inside and have now found new life and are living in that new life in very creative ways, all the way through to high-profile politicians and leaders of justice ministries, people in government, and yet all dwelling together, if you like, under one roof, under the PFI, in the PFI family. There's something which is very rich in that, that is worth preserving, but at the same time, we have national ministries that are operating in some very, very challenging situations often, and we want to help them.
Could you just give us one illustration of that?
Absolutely. I won't mention the particular country, but it's an African nation where I was there a couple of years ago, where we actually had an audience with the vice president, and it was arranged by the national ministry leader, and he was this particular wonderful national ministry leader. Took the opportunity of my visit and somebody else who I had taken along with me, who was a politician in our own country, to really speak to the issue of men and women who had not been taken to trial yet, but where they were spending up to 10 years awaiting trial. And he talked to his vice president about the scandal that was for his country. And I was just so impressed that this man was taking that opportunity in the first instance, that he was acting already in a way that was extremely creative and with great skill. You know, the proverb that we talked about this morning, Dave, show me a man who's skilled in his work, he'll stand before kings and not before obscure men, was absolutely real. in that the work that he was doing on a day-to-day basis, the work that his team and the volunteers were doing on a day-to-day basis, was earning him the right to speak into a situation which was a scandal for his country, but he was being listened to.
But what's interesting to me about that, obviously in and of itself, the fact that you are there representing an international organization, I've always been interested in what shifts take place where a new civil dimension comes into a conversation. Mm. That Prison Fellowship International is there with the local person. Am I presuming here? Does that not also give the local person a whole new opportunity to speak because there's some other ground there?
Yes,
that it makes does. It possible. So it that's does. Very interesting.
And it also, I mean, I don't want to overplay this, but we have a lot of instances where those national ministries say it really means something to be part of a global movement.
Right.
That there is a respect for that that just enables them to get into places that they ordinarily wouldn't. And if we see it right, I see that as being a form of service to them. That is something that we can do that just delights me. If I can help our national ministries, if any of our secretariat team can help national ministries to be more effective, to be more effective as salt and light in their own context, then we're all over that.
So what's your primary aspiration for this period of time when you seek to lead this organization? What do you see as a central challenge and the primary opportunity that faces the organization that you see?
I think one of the primary challenges is not to become so programmatically orientated that we forget that relationship with God and relationship with each other really is, it's the DNA that has, that binds us together. The glue that binds us together is a better way of describing it, which seems to me to be very biblical, actually. That relationship really does trump the programmatic expressions, even though those programmatic expressions are very, very good.
So that goes back to your business.
Absolutely.
That
yes.
The people are not personnel.
That's right.
That what we do together in the world when we're working on anything, that work itself brings together particular kinds of people, but they need to be brought together around things that are really meaningful and deeply human.
That's absolutely right. And I think also we're simultaneously, David, we're in a building up of national ministries and the individuals that are wonderful people all around the world and the wonderful volunteers that get involved with Prison Fellowship National Ministries. We're simultaneously building them up or attempting to walk with them and helping to build them up, because that really is the activity of the Holy Spirit. We just kind of slipstream that and hopefully add a few helpful ingredients. But we're building up in that sense, but we're also deconstructing the barriers of the prison that prevent people who do have a heart that has been moved by grace, have experienced grace themselves, recognize that in people inside prison that they, created in the image of God as well, deserve to hear this amazing message that has so moved us, this undeserved favor that God pours out upon us. We're also lowering the barriers of the prison walls, enabling the church to fulfill this opportunity to minister to Jesus in a way that he talks of in Matthew 25. When I was in prison, you came to me. I mean, what a privilege it is to do that. But prison walls can be pretty high. And what we're doing, I think, is, along with many others, we're not the only ticket to the game. I'm very well aware of that. There are many, many other organizations that are doing very similar work, wonderful, wonderful work. We are not in competition. There's plenty for us all to collaborate on, plenty to go at. But we're lowering the prison walls, enabling that to occur. And in that process of going into with a heart attitude of wanting to serve, and a heart attitude of when I was in prison, you visited me, actually that changes us. And that's probably the best thing of all. But it's maybe not always why we started out doing it, but I'm pretty certain that over time we realize that it really has been more blessed to give than to receive, because in that process something goes off within us, which is, well, we meet the divine.
For good people, a lot of good intentions within the church, to realize that when they encounter the incarcerated man or woman, they're encountering Jesus Christ, is pretty transformative. Mm. You have to catch a plane, Andy. So thank you so much for the conversation this morning. Great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a privilege.
Thank you for joining us. We scratched the surface of many and varied themes. They deserve further thinking. How do good women and men move business beyond money to the creation of healthy and sustainable communities? How are those who understand themselves as disciples of Jesus Christ transformed by engagement with the least of these, my brothers and sisters, which of course includes those incarcerated that Jesus speaks about in Matthew 25? And how do evangelical Christians, with their strong faith, engage in life-giving service with those who have a strong but different faith? Andrew Corley has opened these questions for us, and I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.